Good afternoon, good evening, good morning. It's, as always, a huge pleasure to be with all of you. And welcome to our Q&A session. This is our last Q&A session, but not our last class because we have an extra class on two Wednesdays or Wednesday after next. But this is the time to ask those questions that you just thought of, haven't had a chance to ask, and that we're going to begin by chanting the Shiva invocation and the Kali invocation, and Deb will put on our lead singers.
Panchakrityavitayine Chidanandagana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakrityavitayine Chidanandagana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute. Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute. Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute. Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute.
We offer our practice asking that it be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. So, Deb, we'll start with web questions, and
okay.
Then Deb will be calling on everyone who has your hands raised.
Okay, and in order to raise your hand, you hit star two. So, first a question from the web, Mahika. Could you say more about the practice of entering at the heart of a strong emotion, like fear or anger, that you mentioned during the class when discussing Sutra 18? How is it different from dissolving an emotion into awareness, like we practiced a few weeks earlier?
Oh, Mahite, what a great question. It's interesting. I was just at a board meeting this weekend and discussing this subject with a friend of mine who just published a book called The Art of Fear, which I recommend to you. She works with voice dialogue about it. Voice dialogue being that it's that form of parts work. Some of you know it. Which was developed by Hal and Sidra Stone, and in which you look at the voices that are behind strong emotions. So I was describing this process to her, and so how you enter into a strong emotion, you first of all obviously feel the emotion, and for many of us that actually takes a little bit of practice, because what we tend to do when we have a strong feeling, let's say fear, it's, of course, there's this very visceral experience, but almost always there's a situational story about it. So the first step in entering into a strong emotion is to drop the story. So you first drop the story, and then you feel the feeling. You find the feeling in your body. So in, you know, at this point, it's these two steps, drop the story, find the felt sense, the actual visceral experience of fear or anger, or let's say it's just an uncomfortable feeling. And once you find it, once you can feel it, you actually aim your attention right into the middle of it. How this feels to you will be different at different times. The experience that I have, the way I have learned to do it, is to just imagine myself absolutely in the middle of the feeling. And as you do that, as you feel your way into the felt sense of fear or the felt sense of anger, which is, as you know, it depends on the emotion, but it's a high energy place. It's a strong energy place. See if you can bring your attention into it and then just keep aiming deeper and deeper into it. Some of you have done a practice with me where you imagine a hole in your awareness. You close your eyes, look at the field you see in front of you, or turn your attention backward and find the place behind your heart or behind your back. And then I like to practice by literally imagining an opening or a hole and then moving into it. That's how you do it with the strong emotion. You can imagine an opening and just feel that you're taking yourself into it. Now, there are two possible outcomes for this experience. One is that the feeling will kind of morph. It will start to feel much stronger. Different stories will come up, or different aspects of the story. You just stay with the feeling and keep aiming your attention into it. And what normally happens is that the energy that we are calling fear energy actually it dissolves, pops, or expands, kind of widens. So you just stay with it and notice the state behind it, the state beyond it. And again, the secret here is not going back to the story, not going back to, is the fear all gone? Is the anger all gone? But just to keep staying with it, staying in it, and focusing through it, into and through, so that it's not that you're trying to ignore it, escape it, or get to the other side of it, but what will happen is that the energy will morph and change, and it won't be that original fear energy. The other way to work with strong emotions is to be with it and to notice that the emotion itself, if you're feeling into it, will actually begin to move. as you do this, as you turn into it. Because the nature of emotion, the English word emotion is often parsed as energy in motion, and in fact, energy is always in motion. So your emotions are always going to shift. We keep them in place with a story. And that, you know, the experiment of using the energy of strong emotion to evolve yourself, because that's what it's about. It's not about getting rid of the feeling. It's about really recognizing the energy inside the emotion as energy and learning how to play with the energy. Fear energy is strong. Anger energy is strong. Joy energy is strong. We, of course, tend to like the joy energy more than the anger energy or the fear energy, although if you're a litigator or a soldier or someone who likes the feeling of stress, which a surprising number of us are, you might even be addicted to anger energy. You may like feeling it because it makes you feel energized. Anger is energizing. So, you know, if you're doing this practice, you might get to recognize that you have some ambivalent feelings about strong energies, you know, that part of you wants it, part of you likes it. And many, many insights will start to come up as you play this way with your energies. The deal is not to go with the insight, not to use your intellect to think about why you're having the feeling or what it means, but just to keep letting yourself open through it. So, Mahite, thank you so much for that question. And that's a lot to work with, that one. So let us know how it goes as you practice with it over time.
Okay. We have another one here from Shirley. She says, I feel the channel from the heart to the head, almost no sensation from the base to heart. Do I still need to work on the lower half?
Short answer is yes. And that the feeling that you describe is so completely normal for people like us who tend to be, you know, actually tend to be out of touch with our lower centers. For whatever reason, some of us more so than others. But yeah, my advice, and it's something that I had to learn to do myself, so I can tell you it works, is to just start by putting your hand over the belly center. You can take the four fingers of, let's say, your right hand or whatever hand you're not holding the phone with, and place the tip of the pinky finger right over the top of the pubic bone, in other words, the place where the pubic bone kind of morphs, stops before the soft tissue above it, and then measure four fingers above the top of the pubic bone, and then place your palm over it. And this is going to start bringing the energy to the Hara center, the lower dantian. And then just see if you can imagine that your attention goes into the very center of the body behind where your hand is. You know how we're told to do deep belly breathing, that one of the instructions is to allow the belly to expand, to puff out with the inhalation, and then to draw in back in towards the spine with the exhalation. So that's actually quite helpful as you puff out your belly during an inhalation. Just see if you can bring your attention down behind your hand. In the Tibetan tradition, they will often give a kind of a cue for finding the belly center, the Hara or Dantian center. One of them is to imagine a hot iron ball in that place. I like to do it with the sun. Just imagine a small sun or let's say a round golden circle in your belly center. Or the other alternative, if you like something more peaceful, is a luminous white ball. But, you know, one of the reasons that we use visual cues in meditation is because for many of us, that visual helps anchor our attention there. And at first, it might feel like imagination. You may not quite feel it. That said, using the visual image may be for you a way of keeping your attention in your head. So you want to use the visual image simply as an anchoring device. What you really want to do is feel it, is get as best you can a kinesthetic sense of that center. For many people, that takes time. So if you can be a little patient and just keep bringing your attention there and making the decision, I'll tell you how I discovered this center, actually. My acupuncturist, who's a Taoist, who was always telling me that the key to health, which is a very Taoist teaching, especially for people who do Taoist medicine, Chinese medicine, was to keep my attention full-time in the lower Dantian. And at the time that he gave me that instruction, I had very little awareness of the lower Dantian. So I actually spent about a week making that the focus of my attention. Every time I thought of it, I would breathe in and have the feeling that I was breathing into that center. And after about 3 days, I began to be able to find it. And after about a week, it became, you know, the muscle memory, so to speak, the focus memory of that center became strong enough in me that I could go there. It's very much like becoming aware of awareness. At first, we're going, what? You know, it's so elusive. And then as we keep asking ourselves the question, you know, what is aware, what is the knower, or just tuning into the peripheral vision, getting a sense of awareness as the intelligence, as the holding energy that allows you to experience what you experience, you begin to be able to discern awareness from the perceptions and the thoughts. It's really the same with the lower belly center. And once you've found it, once you have a sense of it, then as you sit in meditation, you can inhale into that center, exhale into the heart, inhale into the heart, exhale into the center of the head. And it'll begin to become natural, and you'll begin to deepen your sense of connection to the Madhyanadi. It'll just get deeper and deeper. So the little work we do, the effort we do to kind of dig the hole, so to speak, or create enough of an attentional connection so that it begins to be present for us, that initial effort is so worthwhile, because at a certain point it'll get so that you can go into the Madhyanadi more or less at will, and then these practices of Sutra 18 begin to become sooner or later second nature. So again, thank you so much for asking that question, which I'm sure is one that many other people have as well.
Okay, we have another question from the web, and Laurel asks, she's trained by Vasheda, Cheda. Anything more to say about initiating invocation?
Wait a
second. Cheda?
Cheda?
Uh-huh. Vaasheda.
Okay, wait a minute.
I'm not sure what that is. So anything more to say about initiating the invocation of Kali and pausing at the sound of K?
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean the vowel was K. Okay. So this is a very mysterious, and yes, it does.
Okay.
It is a very mysterious instruction. One of the things about consonants, and this is a teaching in Sanskrit, about, you know, it's one of the teachings about Sanskrit language, is that we actually cannot pronounce a consonant without an A. In other words, if you really listen to the sound k, it's k, it's not k. So the vowelless k, I'm just doing it as a click, it's a way of focusing that takes you beyond words. So the sound I just made, as if you say, can you hear me? I hope. Deb, can you hear me? It's almost
yes.
Like a clip. Yeah, okay. So if you say that sound as though you were starting to say the word Kali, but are unable to say the whole word, and then rest in the space. And as you do that practice, there begins to be an expansion, an opening. So this is a way of using word, using Matruka, which is the Sanskrit, the Sanskrit name for the letters of the alphabet, the sound syllables. A sound does not make sense without the vowel. So if you can use the power of sound tuning in to just that moment after the pronunciation, it's as though you allow the power in the matruka, the power in the sound syllables of the alphabet, is a form of goddess power. When you don't allow the impulse towards language, towards speech, to fully play itself out by becoming a word, even a sacred word, it's a way of stopping the mind. It's a way of opening up to that which is wordless, even in the midst of words. So again, thank you for the question, Laurel. Deb, do we have more web questions?
Yeah. We have another one. Nobody's raised their hand yet, so just remember star 2 if you want a question on the callers. Jane says, the work of looking into strong emotion has made me aware of a very powerful numbness that I believe has been there forever. I don't seem to feel strong emotion, although intellectually I know that can't be true. Could you please speak to numbness? It feels so subtle.
Yes. Well, yeah, and you're not alone. So let me speak to numbness from a kind of developmental psychological point of view for a moment or two. I know many of you are familiar with this. But when, as children, especially as babies, we feel strong emotion and we can't handle it, which as babies we mostly can't, and of course our parents don't really often can't handle it either. So didn't help us tune into our own emotions. We learn to stuff the emotion, and then instead of anger or instead of fear or instead of the feeling of abandonment, which is what I think it often is, instead of the pain of not being seen or met at a moment of need, as we turn away from an emotion that no one has met, that no one has mirrored, and which we can't meet because it hasn't been mirrored for us, a veil of numbness arises. And the only way to work with numbness is to embrace it. It's kind of like, it's a little bit like a child that won't speak to you. You just put your arms around the child and hold the child, and the child might go rigid, the child might go stiff, the child might demonstrate numbness. But if you keep holding on to the child, sooner or later, something in that rigid body language will start to melt. It may take a while. So the way you practice with numbness is to be present with it. And I would try actually aiming into this subtle feeling of numbness, this feeling of there's nothing there, this feeling of I can't find the emotion. This, you know, you say to yourself, I don't feel strong emotions, which I have to, you know, remind you is a story. So when you look for an emotion and there isn't one there, then the question is, what is there? And if the answer is dullness, numbness, nothing, then just be with that. And as, you know, after I said that, I kind of turned into my own heart and felt the energy in my own heart, which at the moment is actually pretty pleasant. It's, you know, kind of juicy. But I can remember many times of feeling, you know, okay, my heart feels dead, which is not a feeling I like very much. How can I enliven my heart? So the way that I have found to practice with numbness is just the way you practice with a strong emotion. You feel it. You find where it takes you in your body. You stay present with it. And perhaps even go so far as to imagine an opening in that subtle sense of numbness. Maybe ask what's underneath, not with the intention of getting a verbal answer. Remember, this is all about using questions to create a kind of shift. Maybe asking what's beneath it and then staying present with the feeling. And what should happen as you stay with this, and you need to give it a little time. It's not necessarily instantaneous. I would suggest making a decision to practice with numbness and to feel into the space that you call numbness. Imagine an opening in it, bring your attention through it, and just keep noticing what's there. And my sense is that numbness itself, you may find that there are some strong emotions locked up behind the veil of numbness. There very well may be. There may be a lot of unshed tears, which is mostly mostly that feeling of numbness comes, at least in my experience, from unexpressed grief or unfelt grief. Grief that just felt too big at the original grief felt too big to let yourself feel. So that it may mean that grief comes out. But assuming that you're willing to do the experiment, meditating on your numbness by moving into the feeling is going to liberate layers and layers and layers of the cotton wool. That's what I used to call it. When I was in college, which was the time that I became most intensely aware of this numb, dead feeling that I had in my heart at the time. Mostly we try to avoid it. But in the midst of the numbness is the open heart. So the basic principle of Tantra, when you're practicing directly with energies, is turn into it. If you ever have a doubt, just turn into it. And by turning into it, I don't mean turning in again, once again. I don't mean turning into it with the mind or with the intellect or thinking that you're turning into it. You actually do need to begin to cultivate a sense, a felt sense of where the emotion is in the body. And for people who are very intellectually centered, I'm certainly one of them, it takes some practice, but once you find it, you discover that you are now open to the wisdom of the body. behind the numbness is an enormous, enormous resource of energy. So, Jane, practice with it and let me know how it goes, and maybe we can tweak the practice a bit. So I'm seeing some hands, Deb. Who do we want to call?
Go ahead and I just did number one from Ontario, maybe.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sally. It's Trish calling.
Hi, Trish.
From Canada. Hi. I've just absolutely loved the course. I called you on the first night, or spoke and asked a question, the very first question and answer, and I'm asking this question now. It's related to when you're talking about the different place spacings of where you're feeling. You had the hara you talked about. In your book with the heart center, in your book Meditation for the Love of It, on page 257, for the heart, you have it saying approximately 8 finger widths below the collarbone. So it's like taking, you know, one hand, and when you're in the CD Awakening the Heart one, it's,
you know,
one hand and then another. And it comes to that area sort of just below the very part of the breastbone where it goes into that other, the joint. There's like a ligament there. But when you do it in the doorways to the infinite, it you go down from underneath the nose and you do, I think it's
12 finger widths, yeah.
So that ended up being a different place for me, and I just wondered which...
Hold on, I'm checking.
Okay.
Okay, so two things. That 12 finger width, I can't check, I'm holding the phone.
Yeah.
The 12 finger width space, it's the Dwadashanta. Remember, we've been talking about the Dwadashanta in the class on Sutra 18. The Dwadashanta meaning 12 fingers. The 12 finger space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Seems to me it's about the same place. Is on me. You must have funny fingers. No, just kidding.
well, maybe not starting at the right place from the twelve.
Oh, so the place you measure is right under the nostrils. I mean, the place you start. And you go down. But what I wanted to say is it's not, you know, the heart center is a big place. It's not just one little spot. So when I give these cues or these prompts, it's because for many of us, the heart is not open when we first start doing this kind of practice. So we're not really sure where it is.
Okay.
So the sages give us these measuring devices. And then, of course, we think, oh, that means it's, you know, it's in a dime-sized spot.
Okay.
But actually, the heart center is actually enormous. The heart center is not just in your chest. The heart center is, you know, much bigger than your body. So you just want to find the place in your body that is kind of the spot where it starts to open for you.
Okay.
And so I would suggest using the measuring thing and then feeling around with your attention until you find the you know what I mean.
And that's what I sort of, you know, because it is, that's what it does. It feels bigger to me, so that's okay. So that makes me feel better because it always...
Got it.
Yeah, it felt that radiance, and especially doing the meditations and especially the heart to... third eye, that whole thing. It gets so expansive that...
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right. It gets expansive. That little spot, it's like the doorbell. So
okay.
But, you know, when the door opens, you see that it's not, it's big, it's expansive, it wants to expand.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great, that's good. Yeah, I wasn't going to call, I was just going to write you, and I thought, well, people were asking about these things tonight, so I thought I'll just ask.
Okay. We're having a techniques Q&A, which I think is great, so.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sally, for everything.
Oh, gosh, thank you. Thank you.
We have Marion in Australia.
Oh, hello, hello.
Hi, Marion.
Thank you so much. I was just thinking I should lower my hand because this isn't a techniques
No, that's
question.
Fine. No,
oh,
that's
thank
fine.
You. It's a question about duty and sadhana. I have a 93-year-old mother.
Wow.
And we don't live in the same place. She's living in aged care. But I'm having difficulty figuring out how much of my time is spent with love and duty and how much of my time is spent with my own practice. And I don't know how to find the way.
What else are you doing? I mean, do you have, you know, what are the other things going on in your life?
That's about it. I've got health and self-care things, but I'm not working at the moment. I'm just trying to recover from a few injuries that I acquired in an armed robbery.
Wow.
So it's, yes, but the good thing about that was it's made me stay in one place.
Yeah.
I can't really do a lot.
Yeah.
But it's specifically this thing about how much of my life do I care for my mother with, and how much do I care for my practice? I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it makes complete sense. The reason I asked you the other question was just to see if you have, you know, other obligations that you have to give time to. So, without giving you a minute by minute or hour by hour recommendation, I would say that if you want to be healthy, you know, if you want to take care of yourself, which obviously you have to do because one of the hardest things in the world is a situation like that. First of all, you're going to notice, and I'm sure you probably do already, that there are times when you feel like if you don't get out of that room, you're going to kill yourself or you're going to scream.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a signal that you need to, you know, that you're not doing enough self-care. And I would say you actually probably need at least a couple of hours in the day when you are just taking care of yourself. And that includes meditation and practice time. It includes exercise, hopefully, if possible, outdoor exercise. It includes things like taking hot baths and sitting by yourself and noticing how you're chewing. And, you know, there's a kind of a minimum that we have to do, this kind of minimum practice that we have to do daily. And it varies for each one of us, and it varies according to the amount of stress in our life. But when you're in a high-stress situation with a lot of obligations and a lot of duties, it's sometimes very easy to tell yourself that how I feel doesn't matter because this person's need is so much greater than mine. It's very helpful to look at your practice as maintenance. In other words, just as you would have an oil change in the car, just as you would get the car washed, just as you would keep gas in the car, you actually need to do some inquiry into what it takes for you in a given week to stay in your heart, to stay present with yourself, to not give in to stress, to not get upset, to not, you know, whatever your markers are that you're out of your center. Just see if you can do some self-examination and notice the circumstances in which you start to feel stressed, and then ask yourself the question, can I find the time to sit and meditate or do the mantra or take a walk in that moment of stress? Because my advice is that when you start to feel stressed, that you take a break. And I know that that's not always possible, but that is part of our self-inquiry. You know, we all have limits. Some of us are kind of stronger than others in terms of our capacity to be present for people. Stronger is not such a good, but some of us are more caregiving oriented, more extroverted. If it's someone that we love a lot and enjoy spending time with, we have a higher tolerance for being in their company. But everybody has a limit of how much time they can spend in caretaking activities or even in social activities. And when you're at your limit, when you're past your limit, there are signals that take place in your body, and you need to know your own signals. So the signal might be that you feel irritable. The signal might be that your eyes hurt. The signal might be that you start getting a stomach ache or a backache or just feeling impatient. There's a complex of signals that everyone has. And it's just very important when you're caregiving to start to recognize your own stress signals and give yourself permission to take, even if it's 5 minutes to yourself, to sit and close your eyes. So that's one thing that, you know, we talk a lot in these classes about walking around practice, you know, the open-eyed practice, the little breaks you take in the course of a day that sort of bring you in touch with your source. You need to, you know, to give yourself permission to find those places during the day. And my suggestion would be that you carve out some time. If you can carve out an hour for meditation, contemplation, yoga, let's call them spiritual practices, and then a separate time when you take a walk or do some exercise or do a little bit of a workout, so that you're giving at least a couple of hours a day to self-care, if that's possible. And is that possible for you?
Yes, that is possible.
Oh,
thank
great.
You.
That's oh,
very
you're
helpful.
So welcome. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just so much blessings with that, Marianne. I know it's a big time.
I think everybody's had their questions answered, unless I've missed one here.
Okay, so I'm just seeing a hand from Eugene.
Oh, yeah. Okay, someone just raised their hand.
Hi, Sally.
Hi.
It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
How are you?
I'm great.
Thank
How are
you?
You?
Thank you. I'm good. I'm really grateful for this time. And so I'm sorry that I'm the one that has to ask this question, but somebody needs to. You know, at the very end of the class last time, you kind of went into this super interesting secret teachings, sexual teachings, which, you know, I think the very first time that we met was at that yoga tantric conference.
Yes,
and
yes.
I was so indignant that nobody ever talked about sex. So apparently it's really secret. It's still secret, actually. That's the great thing. But I was super intrigued by that practice. And partly just because I spend a lot of time thinking about that work. It was really something that kind of came really easily, just those places.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, totally.
And so, you know, what I'm wondering is that in those three spaces, you know, the root, t- tip and then sort of center. That center that you're referring to is the Dwadashanta center. Also,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
And so, like, if you can just sort of zone right into that space. I mean, the interesting thing is that for me, even in sexual context, that those three spaces, like, you know, that's sort of where you find God, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, but you just answered a question earlier about somebody having less sensitivity below. And so I just would love it if you could talk a little bit more about that secret science and how to integrate that with that sort of inner channel and the heart and up through the head. I mean, I think that's what orgasm does, but
yeah,
there must
yeah.
also be a way to sort of train your mind for that.
So are you talking about, this is the first word that comes to mind, grabbing the energy of sexual excitement and drawing it up?
Yeah, I think that's
yes.
what it, I mean, that's sort of like an ancient teaching.
Yes,
but actually,
yes.
how about even just balancing that between sort of the upper Dwadashanta and the lower? Like, I find when I think about one, I can't quite find the other. You know,
so at this moment, see if you can bring your awareness to the upper Dwadashanta and just keep some part of your attention there, and then bring your awareness into the center, into the either the perineum or the dantian, or just wherever in your, you know, in the, you know, basically the region of your lower pelvis and your genitals, where you find the sense of spark. And it might be that you move your, you know, that your attention goes from one to the other.
Uh-huh. So the idea is to start at the top and then come to the bottom.
Well, I find it easier to start at the top and then come to the bottom.
Okay.
But you may find it easier to start at the bottom and come to the top. But one way to begin this process is to simply switch your attention. I mean, and we're talking about doing it, you know, you're by yourself and you're trying it out. I think it's a whole other story with a partner. And I have to say, I've never done this practice with a partner. So you probably
mm-hmm.
know how to do it as a partner practice better than I do. But in terms of doing it by yourself or doing it, you know, experimenting with the energy of the sexual chakras and the energy of the Dwadashanta, part of the tantric recognition is that because we have, because there is a full realm, you know, in each of these chakras, and we obviously have some of the chakras more open than others. We have more contact with certain chakras than others. That it's often difficult to hold simultaneous attention in the upper Dwadashanta and the lower Dwadashanta. So just move from one to the other.
And so let me just ask one last question. That's helpful.
Is that helpful? Does that, yeah.
Yeah, that is helpful. But, you know, what do you think in terms of the tantric tradition, which I feel like you know better than anybody I've ever learned from, you know, it's like there's this weird association of tantra and sexuality, but it's not this tantra. And yet this is the teachings that have this understanding sort of hidden inside of it.
Right.
And I just kind of wonder, like, is that just sort of the deepest part of the teaching that, like, just is never passed on? Or what's
well,
your experience about that?
I think, well, the, I mean, the subject of tantra and sexuality in the modern West is, it's, you know, there's so much misunderstanding and so much exploitation around sexual tantra in the West. And I have to say, I have never been involved in with a teacher who taught the sexual tantra, or like couples tantra. So
because that's got nothing to do with this.
With what we're doing
tantra.
Here, yeah.
Yeah, but
well,
but
I think it probably does. So from what I understand, there is actually a secret couples tantric practice that is taught they're actually called chakras, chakra meaning circle. I'm not an initiate in that practice. I don't even know who, if anyone, does it. I'm sure there are people who do. But what Kshema Raja does in this sutra is he points to it. I think it's very likely that Kshema and his guru did the sexual practice, did ritual sexual practice, probably with partners. So, but if that tradition has come into the modern world in its pure form, it's come in very small groups, in limited circles, in which there is an enormous amount of practice and probably levels of initiation which make the student ready to do that practice with another person. Because, of course, sexuality is so complicated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So...
But at the same time, like the Shiva Shakti, it's like divinely intimate.
Yes, it is. It is. And, I know people who experiment with their partners with these practices with more or less success, and in a very, in a deep, intimate sexual contact, there often is an opening into divine awareness, right? You actually do experience this kind of Shiva Shakti opening, merging, full body experience with another person. And I do think it's very possible to cultivate it. So part of what Kshema is telling us in what the sutra says is pointing to where you put your focus. So, and what you see is that you're putting your focus in the actual organ of pleasure, whether it's the tip of the penis or the tip of the clitoris. You're putting your attention in the perineum, which is kind of the physical analog of the seat of Kundalini, and which is also a pleasure point in sexuality. But you're also putting your attention into the center itself, into the dantian, so that you're expressing in your meditation the recognition that the deep sexual impulse that is Shakti herself is not confined to the specific area, of classic standard genital sexual pleasure. That is, that it connects you to an inner space, to a chakra, which is connected to the other chakras, both the chakras above and also the chakra, which I think we've practiced this together, the chakra below the body, the lower muladhara. So, in other words, part of what you're doing is not delocalizing, but recognizing the wideness of the sexual impulse. I mean,
reminded me of like what you were teaching about that triangle
yeah.
at the very beginning of the class.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It also creates a triangle, right?
It is a triangle. And you know, and if you remember the symbolism of yantras, you know, this is one of the core geometric formations that's incredibly significant in, you know, in tantric ritual practice and in tantric visual practice, is the triangle. So this particular triangle has the base. The base is lower, the tip is higher in this triangle. So in other words, it's a rising triangle. It's actually in this meditation, it's a Shiva triangle. But in tantric geometric symbolism, the downward facing triangle is a Shakti triangle, because that the downward facing triangle symbolizes the act of creation, bringing source into manifestation. The upward facing triangle is the triangle in which we take manifestation back into the original source. So this, you know, this triangle, this this practice intends to, I would say, widen, raise, expand the sexual energy. And my own experience of this practice is that it happens in different ways. It may rise. You may actually find it coming up towards the heart and the upper Dwadashanta, the Sahasrara. Or you may find it actually expanding through the body. There's one of the words that's related to this, you know, the word vikasha, which means expansion. There's one of the words in this sutra is visa, which means poison. And you know, and it refers to the, you know, the fact that when you take poison, it spreads through the body. So that is the sexual energy, which is Shakti in a very concentrated form, can spread through the whole body, so that you're actually experiencing Shakti as pleasure in a non-local way that is still physical.
The actual really interesting thing is if you're holding your attention on all three of those points, it's not really sexual anymore.
Exactly. It's something else. Well, yeah, exactly. And it's, I would say it's not that it's not sexual, because we have
It's an erotic energy, but it's not necessarily a
genital energy.
A sexual one.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and it's very cool to experiment with it, with the intention that you're not going to, you're not going to discard the energy. You're not going to try to discharge the energy. Not because there's something compulsive about, you know, what happens to us when we get sexually aroused. But the thing is
when you focus on any one of those points, then you get lost.
Yeah.
But if you continuously maintain all three, the pulse is pretty strong.
Yeah, and right on.
Anyway, thank you, Sally. I just think it's really interesting, and I was really grateful that you pointed it out, even though it's secret. So thanks.
Well, I do feel, I mean, it's, you know, first of all, it's in the text. And part of what Tantra is after is getting us to recognize the sacredness of everything in our lives, and that's especially true of sexuality. You know, I mean, sexuality is there are many, many levels of sexuality, many, many states and stages of sexuality. And, you know, but one thing that we know about sexuality is that it's, you know, it's generative, right? You know, I mean, it's creative. So I do believe that what the tantricas understood about sexuality is that if we can use that generative, creative energy to generate and create states of intimacy with with the divine, whether it's in another person or, you know, in the full connection with our own, divine self. And that it, you know, that we need to work with that energy rather than looking at it as dangerous. So, I believe the reason it's secret is because it's very easy to misunderstand and misapply, which is what often happens. You know, I had a conversation with another teacher, another tantric teacher, and who was saying in a very passionate way that in Tantra in the West there are teachers who are using these teachings to exploit students, and I've heard these stories. So that's a very good reason for these practices being secret, you know, so that they're not used by people who are after exploiting or running power trips on other people. So, but I don't think that the practice is meant to be hidden from those who are qualified to work with their sexual energies, just as, you know, they work with their breath energies, just as they work with their emotional energies. You know, these are the energies of life, and they are here to allow us to explore life and allow life to return to its source and then re-manifest, in the body with the exquisite joy of recognizing that every energy in your life can take you to source. So I believe that it's very important to, you know, explore our own sexual energy within a meditative context and work with it, and then see how that energy actually wants to expand your consciousness. So thank you, Wendy, for the work you do in this area. I think you're uniquely qualified to do this meditation and really really discover what it can be for you.
So. Yeah, I've had some pretty amazing direct experiences of God and goddess energy.
Yeah.
So it's just like blows me away. I don't even know how it happened. But
I know. Well, yeah, and it's, you know, not under our control,
you.
Actually.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for all. It's just totally life-changing.
Oh.
And I can't believe it's week 7. So
I know. I know. Yeah. I know. I know. I know. So thank you, Wendy, and everyone. Wolf, I see your hand.
Am I on?
You're on.
Yeah, very quick question. I have worked with Tara for over 20 years and have her statue on my altar, and now I have a lot of pictures and photographs of Bhubaneshwari there, and as I approach my altar, I sometimes seem to get a reproachful look from Tara. So the question is really about the relationships between the goddesses of different traditions. You know, how does Tara relate to Lalita or anyone else, or Kuan Yin on the other side? My own thinking is there must be the same energy, you know, do I project this reproachful look, or is there something there?
That's a very good question. My experience is that we project the reproachful look. But there's several attitudes that we can take towards deity. And in the traditional bhakti attitude, you have one deity, your Ishta Devata, you know, your goddess, and you're faithful to that goddess or that god, just as you would be faithful to your marriage partner in a traditional monogamous marriage. So, and just as in a traditional monogamous marriage, that fidelity creates the possibility of getting very, very deeply into, not just the kind of, quote, personality of the deity, but into what the deity really is, which is Shakti herself, the divine mother energy, the all-pervading goddess. And at a certain point, what's always happened to me and most of the people that I work with is that there is a natural attraction to a different aspect of goddess. So Tara, in the Hindu Tara, Tara is a little complicated because the Buddhist Tara and the Hindu Tara feel slightly different. But the Hindu Tara is part of a group of goddesses called the 10 Mahavijas, the 10 great wisdoms, they're all aspects of Kali, who in that tradition is the kind of ultimate goddess. And they have different faces and different qualities. So Tara has, depending on whether you see her as the Hindu Tara, who's kind of a fierce protectress. She's a protective, loving, holding goddess, but she's also quite fierce. Or say Bhuvaneshwari, who's the great embrace of the Divine Mother, not fierce, but each one of each goddess leads into the vastness of capital G goddess, as we say, as we say God, we say goddess. So Tara, Bhuvaneshwari, Lalita are goddess. And they have, they have individual faces and individual qualities, but at the heart of them is that one vastness that has become everything and is every cell in your body. The heart of them is Chitti Shakti, essentially. So I would say that my intuition, Wolf, is that that the reproachful looks you get from Tara are probably your projection. But you might try talking to her and saying, just having a conversation with her, saying I'm being drawn to Bhuvaneshwari. That doesn't mean I don't love you, just as you would with somebody that you've had a long relationship with. In other words, the thing about the forms of deity is that they are forms of the formless that you can talk to, that you can relate to. So talk to her about it. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Just yesterday night I was in front of my altar and my candle is still in front, Tara, the Buddhist Tara, in this case, is still in the center of the altar. And I was having a conversation with Bhuvaneshwari and I moved the candle over and I just couldn't. It was like, okay, we got to have a talk. And thank you for saying that. That's exactly yesterday. It rushed through my mind, but then I didn't do it, And so thank you.
You're so welcome.
I'll have to talk.
Yeah, this is the time. So, yeah. So thank you for that question.
Thank you so much.
I have the same thing. I despite everything I know about the fact that all goddesses are the one goddess, I still go, oh, wait a minute, I can't say a Saraswati chant unless I say a chant to Lakshmi because Lakshmi might not be happy if I do puja to Saraswati and don't do puja to Lakshmi. That's the thing about individuality in forms. whenever there is a sense of personal relationship, there always has to be dialogue and conversation. Even if it's all taking place in your imagination and it's all a projection, nonetheless, in this intimate universe, when you're moved by the personhood of the divine, then a lot of the practice is being sensitive to, you know, being in relationship. The only thing is, you don't want to get into all those things in relationship that come from our early childhood conditioning, like feeling guilty or, you know, feeling embarrassed, or because actually deities' feelings don't get hurt, but they play with us.
Sally, I know we're a little bit running late, but would you mind taking one more question? Because I totally miss John's and from the web, and I feel bad. He has a question about the encounter with divine figures. Today, while deeply immersed in the meditation to expand the Madhya Sushumna Nadi, the Nadi seemed vast and entirely within me at the same time. And in that space appeared Shakti in her form as Lakshmi. Mm-hmm. I had an odd thought that the Nadi had become so large that it could encompass a goddess, or she's so small as to be within me. My question is, and it may seem rather silly, how should one receive or feel in such an encounter? To me, it feels as if it is often has as sort of ordinary. Something in me thinks that I should be truly gobsmacked, smacked, or would be if I were receiving this encounter fully or if it were real. I have a feeling of a loving, wanting, or yearning. I feel a bit silly asking such a question, and yet lonely if I don't.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I'm glad I...
thank you for the question. You know, in the Upanishads, it said, greater than the greatest, smaller than the smallest. The divine self lives within the heart. So that you just had an experience of how goddess, the divine self, is so big that the entire Sushumna Nadi can show up as a goddess, and so tiny that the goddess can fit into this incredibly slender thread of the Sushumna. So both are true. When you have an intimate relationship with deity, the way deity appears to you is going to, there are many, many ways in which you have that experience, some of them not visual at all, right? You know, there's just this sense of presence that arises. Someone wrote a note to me last week saying that she had always felt that this kind of cozy sense of being embraced had to do with goddess as a personal deity. And then she had a series of experiences in which she recognized that it's her own presence. So, and, you know, and this is both are true. So the goddess is vast, the goddess is tiny, the goddess is a powerful protective force, and the goddess is you. So, this kind of experience you're talking about, or when you see Lakshmi inside your Sushumna Nadi, I think the question that you might ask yourself is, say, what is she showing me? I mean, not that you would do that in meditation, because you want to just be present with whatever is being experienced, but you might just ask, sit after meditation and write. I like to do it by just picking up, having my journal next to my meditation seat, picking up a pen and the journal and just writing. What happened and what insights arose or what insights arise in the aftermath of meditation about it. I mean, the question, what is she showing you? What does she want you to recognize as she appears? On the one hand, you're experiencing a phenomena of a fruitful phenomena of meditation, which is very, very beautiful and alluring and, a gift. And on the other hand, there is a teaching in it. There's a wisdom in it. That's for you. And as we study these texts and we get hints that the sages gave us, or, that comes from the conversation we're having now, those are truths, but there's not one single truth about such an experience. There's many, many layers of wisdom that arise in meditation. So, and we discover those by contemplating the experience, not in a way of, oh, let me hang on to this experience and, maybe make it come back or maybe make it permanent, but just to let yourself cultivate the insights that arise. And, as I think so many of you are experiencing, this practice, this study that we're doing together, it's very, very fruitful just in the aspect of kindling our capacity to experience interiors, our own interior, our own Shakti, and to experience the way in which the lineage energy of the recognition tradition, the Pratyabhijna tradition, really wants to unfold in each of us and will unfold according to our karmic predispositions, according to where we are in our spiritual journey in this lifetime, according to all the factors that come into play in our individual lives. But essentially, we are being opened by Chitti Shakti in her awakening aspect. This is true of every single person who's in this sangham, including those who don't think that you get it or that you don't think anything is happening. This is going on. It's alive. It's living. It's happening, and it's going to continue to unfold in so many ways, surprise you, shock you, blow your mind at times, and the experience that you described is one of those experiences that blows our concepts about, what reality is. So enjoy it and contemplate it. And I just want to thank you for being an open vehicle for allowing this unfoldment, you, John, and everyone else. So we do have one more class. This is not the end, so I'm not going to do a wrap-up. But even when we do the wrap-up, I hope you know that this is ongoing. In other words, this may not be the beginning for some of you, but it is always the beginning. And this expansion and unfolding, which is what the entire journey of the bliss of consciousness, the Chidananda, unfolding into limitation and manifestation while never losing her vastness, her transcendence, we are being very gently guided at a pace we can handle into that realization, what it means for us. And it's not going to end. It's a journey in which there's an ever new recognition of what you are, of what the self is, of what goddess is, of what Shiva is, of what Shakti is. One of my great favorite poet saints, Nyaneshwar Maharaj, says that the experience of the self, of the Atman, is ever new. It never gets old. It's never over. It's never like you've reached the ultimate and there's no way that you can expand more, go further. There's always more. There's always more depth. There's almost always more breath. There's always more love. There's always more insight. And what a wonderful thing it is to live in that understanding that, you know, on a dull day when numbness is all you feel, on a totally expansive day when you feel like you'll never have another bad moment, that, you know, you're drunk with ecstasy, that all of these are part of the way that Shakti teaches us and expands us. And her intention for us is that we be able to walk through the world with the recognition of her full presence within us and around us. So let's just take a moment to close our eyes and turn our attention inside. And we're just going to do a 30-second central channel meditation. Inhaling as though the breath is flowing in through the crown, flowing down the center of the body. And then flowing up, not worrying so much about whether you're finding the lower chakra, just allowing that vertical flow of the breath to bring your awareness into the center of the body. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon, this evening, and giving some part of your day to this, and for all the practice and all the love that you pour into this Sangam. Have a beautiful rest of your encounter with the daylight or the evening, and we'll see each other again on March 7th. The Wednesday after this coming Wednesday for our final class. Thank you so much, and thank you, Deb. Namaste. Big love to all of you.